This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tan Talk Radio Network Studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place to write, and the perfect place to read a good book. Well, I am so excited. I have somebody in the studio with me, and I've been looking forward to having him here, and his writing name is D.Q. Grossa, right? But I'm going to call him Doug, okay?
That's good.
Okay, well, Doug, I'm just so happy that you're here in the studio with me because I started reading your book, and right away I'm in Marquette, Michigan, and as a Youper, of course, I felt at home, and so I'm really excited to talk to you about your book, When Living Becomes Forever, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but I wanted to tell all of you authors out there, you know, I have told all of you, and that is why I bring into the studio once a month, Bill Larson of Larson and Larson, because he is an expert in intellectual property. And I've explained before that I know the problems when you do not protect your intellectual property, and you will be sorry. So, when I tell you that when you are going to sign a contract, you absolutely must get a lawyer. You know, authors are always so excited. They get they might find an agent, and the agent is happy, and the agent, you know, finds a publisher, the publisher is happy, and they send you contracts, and you sign them because you're just so happy. You're happy, happy, happy. But I am telling you, intellectual property is forever. You could have something that it might be a bestseller this year. It might not be a bestseller for 10 years, maybe 50 years. But perhaps whatever you've written at some point will become so timely that everybody's going to want to read it. But if you have not protected your intellectual property, you are going to find yourself a very unhappy person. Oh, I was a very unhappy person at one time. So I can tell you that when you are, especially when you are young and naive, don't sign anything. And by the time you get old, and if you're still naive, don't sign anything. Right? Doug, is that good? Am I giving good advice there?
Yes, excellent.
I am. And Bill Larson he has a wonderful law firm. He is a member of AIPLA, A-I-P-L-A, which is the Intellectual Property Association they are it. They are the experts. And you do not want, please do not use your brother-in-law who is a real estate lawyer, or your sister who does family law, or even worse, your son who is in law school. It's not going to work. Intellectual property law is very, very complicated. You have to remember, there are things you don't know what's going to happen in the future. People who were signing contracts 30 years ago had no idea about streaming video, about listening to books on your telephone, about all sorts of things. That is why an intellectual property lawyer can save you a lot of trouble. And like, you know, I always say literary agents are worth their weight in gold. But a lawyer is your best friend when it comes to protecting your rights. If you've written something and you think it's really cool, so it has value. And it's just like anything you have in your life, if it has value, you want to protect it. You know, you buy a safe for your gun, you buy a lockbox for your jewelry. But intellectual property, it's floating around out there. And you need protection. And I'm talking about this for several reasons, because recently there's been some news. One of the famous agencies, literary agencies in New York, Donato and Olson, had to fold. They went bankrupt. Now, what happened with their clients? I'm sure they tried to arrange everything, but they went bankrupt in a very bad way because somebody embezzled money. And many of their clients were hurt by the loss of this money. It was money that was supposed to be in accounts and was supposed to be paid to authors. And so they faced a terrible, terrible, I mean, it's quite horrific, actually. And then, again, another case that's very important, and this is something that all of you mystery writers out there are aware of. Poison Pen Press folded a while back. And, of course, there are many, many mystery authors who were part of Poison Pen Press. It's a wonder, really, it was a top-notch press, but like everything, you know, businesses come and go because there are problems. Sometimes it's with employees, sometimes it's with not keeping up with marketing, for many reasons. But Poison Pen, although it was a wonderful, wonderful press, folded, and many authors were sort of up in the air. What's happening with my contract? What's happening with my royalties? What's going on? What am I going to get the royalties? Am I going to ever see another penny from them? And believe me, those people who had not actually gone to a lawyer now had to rush to a lawyer. And this is not a good thing. You don't want to be rushing to a stranger now that you're in trouble. Lawyers are there to protect you in the first place. Then, if a problem happens, they know what you have. They know the value of what you have. And they know how to get you all right, to make things right again. Now, we're lucky in that Poison Pen has been bought up by Sourcebooks. But, of course, Sourcebooks is very big, and Sourcebooks is going to use Poison Pen Press as their imprint for mysteries. And they're wonderful people, absolutely wonderful people. Everybody out there is wonderful. But I hate to say this, there are people who will take advantage of you, not because they're bad people, but because it's part of the business model. They're protecting their rights. They want protection for themselves. Yes, they want to be good to you and give you the best royalties and everything, but you have to be there watching what's going on. Well, actually, you don't have to if you have a good lawyer. So again, Bill Larson of Larson & Larson is a fantastic lawyer. Please, please, if you have any questions about anything to do with intellectual property, see him. He'll give you a free consultation. You can talk to him on the phone. You can go into his office. But you must do this because you don't know what you're signing away if you don't know what you're signing in the first place. Again, personal experience, please, please see a lawyer. And that's all I'm going to say about it. Until next month, Bill is going to be here. As a matter of fact, the intellectual property, APLA, is going to have their big convention here in January. So he's going to come and report to us everything that he's discovered. But meanwhile, think about it and just protect yourself. Is that a good idea, Doug?
Excellent idea.
Tell me, Doug, before you started writing, what did you do?
I was a school psychologist.
A school psychologist. So you understand psychology. You understand
a little bit
that people, when they're really happy, sometimes don't really think things through. They might just say, I'm so happy. Right?
Yes.
And like you fall in love and you are just, you see this guy, you're just, I'm in love. That's it. It's over. And you don't go any further than that. And then next thing, you're in trouble. Or it could work out the other way, and you could just instantly fall in love, which I did, and everything turns out great. But you never know.
Exactly.
You
exactly.
Never know. And so now you're. I'm in a funny position with you. You don't actually have a book for sale. I mean, I think you are the first. I think you are the first author I have ever had on who doesn't have his book for sale. And I don't have to say, go out and buy his book today, because you can't. And I was thinking to myself, that's crazy, because he's got a great book. I love When Living Becomes Forever. I thought it was so clever. The ideas were so clever. And we're going to start back at the very beginning when I got excited about this book because it takes place in Marquette. I love Marquette.
I do too. It's a wonderful place to be. I've traveled many places in the world, actually about over 80 countries, and been around the world 5 times. And Marquette, to me, is probably one of the most beautiful places in the world.
It is. And it's 72 miles from where I was born in Berga, Michigan. And I know that because we would go to Marquette. I mean, it was a big deal for us to go to Marquette. And we would be so, so excited. I think we went at least once a year. Somewhere for some reason in February, because I remember one of my fondest memories is that and I've paid for this over and over in my life, is we went to Marquette, and it was in February, and we went to the department store, which, you know, was a big deal because in Berga we don't have department stores. And I bought this beautiful purse that had a Valentine on the front of it. And it was so gorgeous. And I've kept that purse in my mind forever. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
So what brought you to Marquette?
Well, I was in the Navy, and I wanted to go to college. And I didn't know much about college at the time because I was only 17, 18. So I applied to several colleges. And Northern Michigan University accepted me, as well as a few others. But I had relatives in Marquette, so I thought, how nice would it be to be close to my family? Because my parents lived in Detroit area, Royal Oak. And so I went 480 miles north to Marquette, which is a long way to go to school from your hometown.
And it is nice to have relatives. At least you get a home-cooked meal, right?
Yes, exactly.
Of course, you don't have a problem in Marquette, though, because you can always find a pasty.
Exactly.
So you are happy camper. You are a very happy camper if you are in Marquette, or if you're in Houghton, in Hancock, where you have Michigan Tech University, and there again you can have pasties. So for all you people out there who don't know what a pasty is, tell everybody.
Well, it's a mix of different meats and potatoes and carrots wrapped in a dough, and it's really quite good.
For anybody who has lived in the Upper Peninsula, and those of us who were born there are called youpers, or as we always say in my family, super duper youpers. It's a pasty and coffee, and that makes life complete.
Exactly.
Isn't it amazing? So you went to university there?
Yes.
And had a good old time. Did you ever do the ski jump?
We would ski at Cliffs Ridge, which uh-huh. is a little ski hill outside of Marquette. Uh-huh. We also climbed Sugarloaf Mountain, which is on the way to Big Bay, Michigan. And Big Bay, by the way, is the setting for The Anatomy of a Murder. Uh-huh. So those of you that know that story.
And the movie was actually shot there in the courthouse there in Marquette. If you watch that movie, Jimmy Stewart. And I've met a couple of people who were there at the time or were extras. And they still remember. They were kids then, but they still remember that Jimmy Stewart, who was so wonderful.
Yes, he was great in the movie. And the book is an excellent, excellent novel.
It is. Well, and I noticed that when I looked at Marquette's website on Wiki, that they mentioned the movie and they mentioned the book. And I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, pretty soon we're going to look at that Wikipedia site for Marquette, and down at the bottom they're going to have author D.Q. Grossa, and When Living Becomes Forever.
Well, that would be wonderful if I could.
Well, I think, of course, what we have to do is get this published. Once it's published, then somebody can go on to the Wikipedia site and put your name.
That would be great. And any help that your listeners could give in terms of publishing my novel, I would be appreciative.
Well, you know, let's talk about the book because, as I said, when I read it, and I fell in love with it right away. I liked the concept of somebody, the story of somebody who lives forever, and you'll explain about where he goes back in time in this book. And I just thought, well, that's great. Now, you know, so I'm I'm looking forward to interviewing this guy. And so I go to look for, you know, where it's for sale. And I'm saying, it's not for sale. And I'm saying, how can such a great book not be for sale? It is very well written. It's this sample is beautifully produced. And tell us about the story, because I think it's fascinating.
Well, yes. The story is about a man who has an anomaly, a physical anomaly, which causes his DNA to signal his body when he reaches the age of 70 to start to reverse age. He reverse ages seven physical years for every calendar year. So he actually becomes younger. And after 7 years, seven calendar years, he looks to be about 20 years old. So he starts reverse aging at about the age of 70. And for every year, he reverse ages about 7 years. Now, imagine what this would be like if this were you and this happened to you. First of all, you'd begin to wonder, what's happening to my body? I'm getting younger. The next thing that would happen, would your family would say, what is happening to you? You look different.
Well, facelift time.
Yeah, exactly. So it's actually for the first time this happened to Matthias, which takes place back in ancient Rome. He didn't know what was happening to him, and he had to sort of leave his family to see if he could find out what was happening to him, because they were all saying, you're getting younger. What's going on? And he had to leave his family to see if he could discover from wise men, from various people in different parts of ancient Rome and Byzantium, why am I getting younger? He went to snake charmers. He went to priests and rabbis to find out, why am I getting younger? Well, they thought he was crazy. You're not getting younger. You're just you. So as it turns out, he does leave his family, and the story goes on from there. It actually starts out in Marquette.
Yes, which is why I got hooked. I mean, the minute I said Marquette, I got to it. I said, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. Somehow, whenever I think of the Upper Peninsula, I need a cup of coffee anyway. People in the Upper Peninsula drink a lot of coffee. Especially the Finlanders, and being a Finlander, coffee is like, yeah, I need it all the time. So I get a cup of coffee, and I said, I've got to read this. And it was so much fun, because you described Marquette so nicely. I was like, I'm there. And then, you know, I thought of this idea, and it's a fascinating idea. And nowadays, when we're thinking about, could that ever happen? With the way they are fooling around with our DNA, and gosh knows these experiments they're doing, which are sort of frightening, really, when you think of all this manipulation they're doing, that it might happen to somebody. I mean, it really, who knows what they're doing? It's getting sort of insane out there. So when you got this idea, I mean, how did that idea just pop into your head?
It popped into my head about 30 years ago.
30 years ago. So it's been fermenting in there. He's going back in time.
So I met my wife when we were dating, and she wanted to get married, and I didn't.
Ah.
And I said, you know, you can't marry me. I'm a 2,000-year-old man, and I'm going to live forever.
You didn't do that.
Well, I said that to her. Of course, you know, I was joking.
Yeah, you were. Okay.
And so the idea came about writing a story about a person that...
Because you're just a little bit... goofy, and you're
I must be a little bit that way.
Okay, that's a nice opening. Yeah.
So anyway, the book starts out in Marquette, where a young neurosurgeon meets Sarah. And by the way, the story is written in Sarah's voice. So it's when people ask me, Doug, this isn't you. This is written by a woman. Well, essentially, it is written in Sarah's voice, and that's why I've entitled my name is D.Q. Grossa, because you really don't know who D.Q. is. It could be a woman or a man. But at any rate, Sarah meets this neurosurgeon, Matthew, and he tells her that he's 2,000 years old. Well, of course, come on, nobody's 2,000 years old. But she falls in love with him. And then he exposes her to the story of his life, which goes back to 62 B.C.
And the story unfolds. It's really very nicely done. I thought the reveal was very nice, the way you take us back in time. And obviously you have done some nice research on Rome and about that period. So, you know, that's it's just, I read I get a lot of fantasy, I get a lot of sci-fi, and I wasn't sure where to exactly put this, but I thought, I just like the idea. I'm not sure about the idea of living over and over, but the idea of the value of life, and that it's so interesting when you're thinking, if somebody lives that long, will they be happy even in like 100 years? Is it good to live 100 years? And nowadays, of course, I think this generation of kids, unless things get worse and worse, could live to be 120, which is a Jewish concept, live 120 years. So I just thought the whole story was fascinating. And I'm going to take a little break. And then I want to play a book buzz, a special holiday book buzz for an author who I love, and I hope that you'll get her book. It will be a wonderful read over Christmas. We'll do that because Rita Moreau, my book buzz gal, has done this especially for Carol J. Perry, who is one of my favorite authors. And we'll play the book buzz, and we'll do commercials, and we'll come back, and I want you to explain about your interest in Rome, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz mystery, Bells, Spells, and Murders, a Witch City Mystery by author Carol J. Perry. And here's the buzz. Lee Barrett has landed her dream job at Salem's Witch TV. As a new field reporter, she'll be covering events live as they're unfolding. Next on her holiday checklist is an interview with the beloved chairman of a popular walking tour through Salem's historic districts. But it may be his ghost walking this snowy Noel season after Lee finds him murdered in his stately offices, bloody Santa hat askew. With her police detective boyfriend working the case and a witch's brew of suspects, including some bell-ringing Santas, Lee chases down leads aided by her wise cat, Orion, who I love, and some unsettling psychic visions of her own. When a revealing clue leads to another dead body, not even a monster blizzard can stop Lee from inching closer to the truth, and a scoop that could spell her own demise this killer Christmas. But don't take it from me. From RT Book Reviews, an entertaining story that keeps readers guessing until the very twisted and eerie end. Carol J. Perry has done it again in Bells, Spells, and Murders, just in time for the holidays. This is Rita Moreau, also known as Radio Rita, reporting for Joy on Paper.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660, or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Guest here in the studio, DK Grossa, or Doug as I'm going to call him, because I really love anybody who's from Michigan and who just loves Michigan, and especially the Upper Peninsula. Okay, Doug, this is exciting. We're talking about a book that's not published yet, and it's called When Living Becomes Forever. Now, we assume that you are going to publish it soon?
I hope so.
You hope
so? Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, it's always difficult for an author to decide how to go about publishing. You can become a self-edited, self-publishing, an indie author. And there are many who have become really quite successful. Denise Grover Swank, who has been on my program many times, she just hit, I was talking to her recently, and she just hit 2.6 million books. 2.6 million, I am telling you that. And she did it because... this is one determined woman. I mean, she wrote a business plan and she stuck to it. And in about 8 years, she's managed to sell that many books. It is not easy to be an indie publisher, as I've explained to Doug and to all of you out there. But it's a choice. You can do it yourself, but then you have to be able to also put in the time to market it yourself. You have to have a smart and clever campaign to promote your book, because it's very nice to put it on Amazon or Smashwords or any place where books are sold, but unless you back it up with real marketing programs, it's not going to sell. So that's one way. The other way is to try to find an agent. Well, we'll go to the second way. The next way is find a small publisher. You still have to do a lot of the work, but when you have a small publisher behind you, for example, Carol J. Perry, who we just did her a book buzz for her eighth book, she is published with Kensington. Now, Kensington is a small imprint, but a fantastic group. They do so much for their authors. They promote their authors, and since Carol first came on the program, she had one book, and in the 3.5 years I've been on, she's now up to 8 books, and working on her 9th book, and she's several times been in the Barnes & Noble end cap display at Barnes & Noble, which is a big deal. When you are in all over 3,000 stores across America, this is a big deal. But Carol deserves it. She has worked hard. Her books are great. She has really learned her craft. And she also goes out there and promotes her books, which is still essential. And even if you're with a big, big publishing house, you could be with Penguin, you could be with any of the big ones, Random House, even if you're picked up by one of them, you still have to do marketing yourself. They give you about 3 to 6 months where they will go out and promote your book. But then after that, you have to do it. So what have you decided to do? You're going to try to publish it yourself, or you want to try to find a publishing house?
Possibly both. I'd like to thank Catherine Long from our Newport Richey Writers Group, which, by the way, all of our Newport Richey Writers Group authors are excellent resources. And I would encourage anybody who is interested in writing a book to get into a writer's group, because you can get a lot of good feedback. Sometimes it's a little bit tough to handle because you get critiqued.
Believe me, no writing group is as tough on you as a New York editor. When your book is picked up, if you think the little comments that you get at a writer's group in your hometown are tough, you're not ready for the big time, because I have spoken to New York City editors, and they're telling me, you know, it's sort of sad, they have brought major best-selling authors to tears because they have corrected things. They have suggested things that they do, because if you're a big-time New York City editor, you're interested in making the book as great as possible. So you have to be tough. So they will. one New York Times editor actually sent to, now this is a Pulitzer Prize winning author, she sent a 3-page critique of 1 page of his book, and she said he came back to me, he said, "You know, I won a Pulitzer Prize." And she said, "Yes, I do." And she said, however, that page really needs work. And then after a little break, he said, "You're right. I thought that was a good suggestion." So that was the last call like that she got from him. But it's important. You're right that to be in a writing group that encourages you, that that really is looking for your best interest, is wonderful, and really accept any critique that they give with real generous spirit, because everybody knows that before you contact a New York literary agent, your book has to be as good as you can get it. I mean, you don't want to be rejected because they come back and say, "Well, there are too many grammatical errors," or "This is this," or "This is that. I can't read it." You know, you want it to be as good as possible. Now, I think your book is great. And the funny thing is, I was mentioning to you, Nancy Peacock wrote a book, a self-published book, and it got nowhere. She put it on Amazon, it got nowhere. But then she submitted it to the Writer's Digest competition. Whoa, she got noticed. And she got a big publishing contract with an advance, let's say a 6-figure advance. Those are wonderful words. 6-figure advance. 3 of the most beautiful words, I think.
Sounds good to me.
Sounds good. Six-figure. The only thing better than a 6-figure advance is a 7-figure advance. And there are some authors who have gotten those. And unknown authors, too, by the way. So you never know. Now, another author who became very famous, and she's been on my program too, is Gail Honeyman, and she wrote a book called Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine, and it's going to be a movie produced by Reese Witherspoon. Reese Witherspoon's too old to play the lead part in it, but anyway, so Gail is a very happy person, but she actually submitted, and this is funny and sort of not something I would recommend. She submitted a part of her book. She actually hadn't finished the book. She was like, "I don't know, this is probably is nothing, it's garbage, nobody's ever going to want to read it." So she just sent it to a competition in England. And she was like, she was depressed. She wasn't drinking quite as much as her character in her book, but she was not a happy camper at that point. And then you have to remember, in a major competition, and you have to, if you're going to enter in competition, you have to enter the major competition. The readers are real literary agents or real editors. They're not just secretaries or the mailroom guy. You know, by the way, I want to mention, speaking of mailroom, so often people will send scripts. They're not doing it so much anymore, but up to a few years ago, people would send entire scripts to Hollywood people. They'd send it to the Hollywood people, to the studios, to all the famous people, direct. And the only people who would read those scripts would be the mailroom people, who actually would steal those story ideas. So don't do that. But Gail, a real agent, a London agent in this case, read it and got to the part where she just stopped. I mean, nothing. It didn't continue. And the agent said, "Well, I want to read this book. I want to read this book." And she actually got a contract based on a partial book.
Great.
And five figures in her case, because in pounds at the time it was, but it was good. So you have to weigh that if you want to go that way.
And I agree, and I'd like to make a comment about criticism, which we had talked about just a few minutes ago. The first criticism I had was from my father-in-law, and I had just finished maybe five or six chapters, and I took it to his house, and he was reading it. I said, "What do you think of this?" And he was reading it, and then he laughed at a part in the book that was supposed to be very sad. One of my characters dies, and I said in my writing, "And then she was gone." And my father-in-law looked at me and he said, "Well, where'd she go?" I thought, well, this is supposed to be the saddest part of the book, and he's making light of it. I went back and I rewrote that entire page so that I took out "and then she was gone" with something a little bit more powerful than "she was gone." So you have to take your criticism from everybody, even those that you love, like my father-in-law, and even those that you don't like people I like my writer's group people, but people that you don't know as family. So criticism is excellent, and every time someone criticizes and critiques my work, I take it very seriously and not sadly. I look at it as something I need to reflect on and go back and consider changing things and revising.
Okay, well, I don't have anything bad to say about this book. I don't have anything critical to say about this book because I like it just the way it is. And because I've always been very interested in Roman history. I was interested in, I started my real interest in Roman history in Latin class because I love Latin. That was one of the only classes I loved in school. Latin, I love Latin, and I loved chemistry. Chemistry because in those days we were allowed to get away with things that we could not do today because then, you know, all of those authorities would come in and get us because we actually made stink bombs. Nowadays, we'd be arrested, we'd be taken away and put in Guantanamo or something. But in those days, we had lots of fun in chemistry class. It was a hoot. And Latin, I only liked two classes. I hated all my other classes, and especially my writing classes, because as we were talking about, I have read over 10,000 books. So by the time I got to high school, I had been reading for many years, since I was 3 years old. And my mother taught me to read by, you know, running her finger along as she's reading the comics. I'd read probably 2,000 books by the time I was in high school. And none of my English teachers had read that many. And as a matter of fact, one of my English teachers she was the advanced novel teacher. And the first thing she announced, she wrote her name on the board, she sort of leaned back on the desk and smiled at all of us, because there were only 20 students capable of taking an advanced English course. And she said, "You know, I've never been able to finish War and Peace." And I'm in for it now, boy, oh boy. Because by that point, I'd read everything Tolstoy wrote, his diary, I mean everything. And I'm thinking, I don't think I'm going to get along with this lady. And I didn't. But so it's wonderful. And as I said, I love Latin. And because that was really my class, I did the whole 4 years. Why did you take him back? Why did you start there in
Rome? Okay, well, part of the reason is that I'm Italian. And I've been to Rome and Italy many times because I still have relatives there. And I wanted to take the character back to ancient times because he's a 2,000-year-old character. It starts out in the 20th century, and his girlfriend goes into this secret library room where he has collected all of his parchments and scrolls over the 1,000 years that he's been alive, and he tells her the story that he's 2,000 years old. Well, of course, she doesn't believe him. She thinks these are just artifacts that he's collected from vintage bookstores. He tells her that he was born in 62 BC, and of course she doesn't believe him. But she wants to be with him, and he has another more altruistic goal in life, and that is to find, as a neurosurgeon and a physician, he wants to find cures for diseases like dementia and cancer. So she follows him around the world while he does his research, and also writes his story of being 2,000 years old, which she doesn't really believe, but she thinks it's a good story. And the book goes back and forth between ancient Rome and the 20th century because his life takes place in ancient Rome, his first life. And then his next life takes him to other parts of antiquity, for example, India and Turkey and Byzantium, which was called Byzantium in those days. And the story advances from there. Now, of course, the story doesn't go the whole 2,000 years because the book would be too long. But and it does have some surprise twists in the ending, I think. Even my wife looked at me and she said, "You ended it this way? Why did you do that?" Well, that's part of writing, I guess.
And I think it's good. I think I love it. I was, as I'm reading, I'm thinking, how's the hell he's going to end this thing? And I thought, well, and at a certain point, I thought, well, I don't want him to end the thing. I want more. I want him to go to more places. I want to hear more stories, backstories. But yeah, it is. It is. And that's why I'm thinking that. You know, it's not easy. As I said, it's not easy to find an agent. But sometimes there's, you might just want to go like the competition way. You might want to enter, and I wanted to tell everybody that the Reader's Digest competition, which is really a fantastic thing. And as I mentioned that Nancy Peacock won in there and then got a big deal, publishing deal. It is, the deadline for that one is May 6, 2019. And, you know, the months go quickly. So if you're thinking about submitting a book, you can't wait till the last minute. You have to make sure, you have to fine tune it, make sure everything's really great, and enter it. You never know. It's you know, you're, sometimes you just hit the right person at the right time. And in this case, I think this book is very clever. And again, to find an agent, over the next few months, I'm going to have a number of agents on. I've already had many famous agents on Joy on Paper. And I just love to talk to agents because I like to know what they're thinking, what they're looking for. Donald Moss has been on, Mark Gottlieb of Trident, Trident is the top literary agency in New York City. Of course, Irene Goodman has been on many times. So it's worth looking at finding an agent who might be interested in this type of book. Because, as I said, it's well written. The story's fascinating. I love the ending. And you have to sometimes just try these things. It's not easy to write a query letter that will catch an agent's attention. I hate to say this, but it is so difficult. It really is. They get so many. That's why when you are looking for a literary agent, that you make sure that you find one who's not that they've done something similar, but that they have a certain, you get a feel when you're looking for a literary agent. It is a lot of research. You have to go to their websites, and each agency might have five agents. Only one agent is worth pitching to, because they'll mention, oh, they've done some history, they like Rome. You don't know what they'll say in their little bios, but you have to do that. You can never send a query letter just to an agency. You have to have a name, and you can't just send it to any agent in an agency. You have to find one that you feel would be simpatico with you. And then try. And you do many agency. I mean, you wouldn't send, in the old days, well, I'm talking 40, 50 years ago, you'd write one to one agent and wait. And in those days, you'd wait 6 months even for a nice rejection letter. And it was a nice rejection letter because they'd send it on beautiful letterhead from New York City. And if you were smart back then, you actually saved those things. And I do know one writer who was very smart and saved all of her rejection letters and has an entire wall covered with them, which, you know, it's nice. It's very distinctive. Of course, most people, when they get a rejection letter, they just crumple it up or tear it up and chew it up, swallow. I don't know what people do with it. Of course, nowadays it comes on email, so it's not so pretty, you know. And I think if you, in the older days, if you have a relative who's an author and you are digging through their papers and there's a rejection letter complete with the envelope and the stamp, whew, that could be valuable. That's nice. There aren't enough out there for, you know, so it makes it really valuable.
Well, I'm going to save all my rejection letters.
Well, you're only going to get emails nowadays. They're really lazy. They will not. They don't waste money. But it is, you know, it is something I think that you should consider. There is that sort of, I want to get it out there. But if you're very energetic, I mean, if you're really ready to put the time, you're retired from psychology, and you survived that. Where'd you teach psychology? In high school?
I was a school psychologist, and we worked overseas for 3 years in Bangkok and a year in Australia, and then Michigan, and also in Florida. So I've worked.
But he's retired now, so he can spend all his day marketing. Marketing is, writing is the fun part, isn't it?
Yes, I say that writing a book is an art. Selling it as a business.
Exactly. And that's why I call this program Joy on Paper, because it is so much fun, the writing part. It just, you get such a good feeling when you see your words on paper and, wow, you wrote it. Does that sometimes grab you that
it's,
you...
It's wonderful.
And you go back and you say, did I really write that? I'm really good.
Exactly. My wife says, did this come from you? And I said, I did not plagiarize anything.
I know, and that's a wonderful feeling. And I think that, I mean, I just like this, but I want everybody to read this book. I think the idea of, and people are thinking about living longer. And recently I was talking to a 100-year-old woman, and one of the things is, if people are going to live a long time, it would be really nice if they would have lots of interests and not be boring. And, you know, if you're going to live a long time, be an interesting person. You know, have something to talk about. Read books. And actually, if you go to seniors' homes, the people who are the most alive, the most vigorous, are the ones who read, because they've kept their minds active.
Exactly.
And here, you wrote, your character is a neurosurgeon. And this is part of the whole thing of the mind, that you have all these neurons. When we talk about neurosurgeon, there's neurons in the brain all sort of out there, and you have to keep them active.
Exactly.
Exactly, right?
And writing helps, and reading does too.
Exactly. Now, so you finished this book.
Yes.
Are you on another book?
People tell me that it's ripe for a sequel, and I started a sequel, but I don't know yet.
You don't know yet. Well, see, that's one of the things... I mean, I could go. I want to know more. I really do. I really enjoy this character. So tell us a little bit about Rome and what life was in Rome for him.
Well, for him, he was from a wealthy family. His father was a senator, and he owned a large farm. So he was an aristocracy, He meets different people along the way, and one of the persons he meets, I don't want to be a spoiler, one of the persons he meets when he was very young happens to be killed by someone just on the Ides of March, just the day before Caesar was killed. And, of course, he wants to find out who this killer is of his girlfriend. And so he pursues that, and the story develops from there.
We have this nice little mystery in there.
Yes.
So that's why I think this book is... so fascinating. It's rich. It's one of these books that's rich. You learn things. You come away from it, and you say to yourself, "Oh, I didn't know all that. That's really great."
And I did do a lot of research on Roman history, so I think it's pretty accurate.
I think that is really one of the real joys of reading, is when you find a book that, well, captures your interest, a character that captures your interest. And certainly you have done that. And then where you also learn little things. And that's one of the interesting things. When you learn little, you're learning without sort of knowing. Nobody's preaching to you. You're not being taught, but it's just you. You just get it, and it's wonderful.
No, it's invigorating.
It is. Yes. It is. It's very invigorating. Well, DK grows up.
DQ.
DQ. DQ. DQ. DQ. Okay, DQ. Sorry about that. DQ Grosse. I think it's great. By the way, I did a research. And did you know that Grosses have a higher lifespan than the average people?
Well, I should tell you the DQ. My last name used to be Quercia Grosse. And so this is really my middle initial. It's a long Italian name, and there's really a
say
city.
Say it again.
Quercia Grosse. Quercia Grosse.
Oh, my sister will love that. She speaks Italian, and she loves everything Italian.
So there's actually a little city called Quercia Grosse not far from my family's home area.
Oh, that's clever. DQ Grosse, because nobody else is going to be able to pronounce that, except my sister Natalie. She'll be able to say it. She'll be so proud of herself because she loves Italian. And that's great. So we will. What I want to do is I'm going to have you back on the release date of this book. So when you decide to release it, whether you do it independently or you find a small publisher or a big publisher.
Well, thank you.
You're going to be back here because I think it is a book that people will enjoy, and I think you're absolutely delightful. And
well, thank you, Patsy, and thank you so much for having me on your show. And I'd like to thank again my writers group, Catherine Long and Larry, our chairperson, and all.
And Larry hasn't been down here yet, so we had a bunch of the other guys there from the group, and we're going to get some more. And I'm going to come up and talk to your group too because. Well, I hope that I can give you some ideas on marketing. I'm working on marketing ideas for authors because that is the name of the game. And I just, again, thank you so much for coming to the studio today.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for reminding me of Marquette, which I love. And hello to all of my relatives up there. They are freezing. They sent us some cold weather here a little bit. They can take it back. Okay, I had enough. I'm telling my brother, take back the cold weather. I like it for a few weeks so I can have pea soup, and that's about it. I want it to go away. Anyway, remember, everybody, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're really lucky, to one day hear those words, lights, camera, action, and just see your book being made into a film. And I could make this into a film. This would be fun. When Living Becomes Forever, and it's going to come out sometime. I'm sure in 2019 we'll be able to buy. You'll all be able to buy it, and I'm so lucky. I get to read all these books before all of you. And which reminds me, I've got Brad Meltzer coming up. I just got his book. I've got so many wonderful authors coming up in 2019. It's really exciting. I'm just so thrilled. And remember to go to my Facebook page. I've switched the name around. It's now Joy on Paper Radio instead of Radio 2. Anyway, find it. You can just write Joy on Paper. And my Facebook page will come up. And you can like me. And I will like you because I like everybody today. I'm a youper. I'm a happy, super-duper youper. And I want to say thank you to Big Ed in the control room. And he salutes me. And I salute him. And bye-bye, everybody.